Hey, podcast listeners. Just a quick reminder that I do have a book about the psychology of video games out. It's called Getting Gamers, the Psychology of Video Games and Their Impact on the People Who Play Them. And I bring it up because this week, given the subject and the guests that we have on, I'm going to read in just a minute the first section of chapter 14. Why do we like violent games so much? And should we be worried that we do? It sets up the interview pretty well, and if you find any of this interesting, there's a lot more discussion like it within the rest of the book. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Welcome to the Psychology Games Podcast, where you learn about how psychology and video games interact to shape our behaviors, our beliefs, and our purchasing decisions. My name is Jamie Madigan, a psychology PhD and a lifelong gamer. I write, podcast, and lecture about this stuff on psychologyofgames.com, and I'll be your host. I once murdered dozens of innocent people in a Moscow airport. Well, in a video game. The No Russian mission in Activision's Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 gets its title from the warning given by the game's villain right before the shooting starts. Vladimir Makarov is a radical Russian revolutionary who wants to commit mass murder and then pin it on US and NATO forces in order to foment civil unrest. Thus, he warns his men to only speak English and no Russian right as the mission starts. And then just to make things that more dramatic, my avatar at that point in the game was a CIA spy placed in the extremely difficult position of maintaining his cover during the slaughter. I needed to play along or I'd be found out and killed. As the level started, Makarov's crew and I began a slow walk through the Zakhov International Airport and opened fire. Travelers, airport staff, and tourists screamed, pleaded for their lives, and tried to protect family members from the impassive gunmen. Their efforts were futile. I remember thinking that the cold, steady nature of the executions in the game was strongly reminiscent of stories about the Columbine High School shooting that had happened about 10 years before in real life. And there I was, participating in it. Technically, I didn't actually have to shoot anyone to complete the No Russian mission. Turning your guns on Makarov and his goons resulted in instant mission failure, but you could just watch the violence without otherwise participating if you wanted. Or if that's too much, the mission could be skipped entirely. The game presents you with that option both in the process of starting a new game and at any point during the No Russian mission. What's more, there's no points, achievements, trophies, weapon unlocks, or alternate endings to be missed if you do skip it. But as I said, I played through the whole level, and so did, I assume, millions of other gamers who bought Modern Warfare 2. I still felt complicit in the virtual murders in that I had allowed them to happen. And the whole experience felt more violent and criminal than blasting cyber demons, aliens, or even human soldiers in an opposing army. I'm not the only one who has arched an eyebrow at the increasing levels of violence and gunplay in video games over the last 30 years. The study of how psychology and video games interact is frequently dominated by the question of whether video games cause violence outside of the game. On multiple occasions, I've been approached by talk show hosts or members of the press who want to quiz me on how much violent games were responsible for a school shooting, stabbing, or similar tragedy. I usually decline because it's such a loaded question, and the person often wants me to support a particular viewpoint regardless of the details of the case in question. The United States, in particular, has a long history of these moral panics, during which real or imaginary woes are claimed to be the result of comic books, popular music, movies, tabletop role-playing games, or even pulp fiction novels. It was inevitable that video games would get their turn. Many outlets in the mainstream media certainly agree. In 2013, the Journal of Communication published an analysis of how violence in media topic was described by 450 articles from the 25 highest circulated newspapers in the United States over the last 30 years. According to the researchers, 53% of the pieces suggested that consuming violent media increases violent behavior, but only 9% told readers that there was no such relationship. The balance of the stories, 38%, were neutral on the topic or said that the relationship was unknown. Politicians and groups advocating for the welfare of children also frequently champion the idea that violent games cause violent behavior. Without firsthand experience to temper them, these kinds of stories and public relations campaigns become entrenched in people's beliefs through psychological mechanisms such as the familiarity bias. That is, We tend to think things are true if they're made easier to remember through dramatization and repetition. One survey found that older Americans, age 65 and over, who never or rarely played video games were 6 times more likely to believe that violent games cause violent behavior. Naturally, this annoys many gamers. Those of us who enjoy first-person shooters and other violent games aren't keen on being labeled murderers in training or burgeoning sociopaths just because we occasionally use virtual guns to spray fictional bullets around a pretend Moscow airport. Some studies have found that those who identify themselves as gamers are much more likely to be skeptical of, or even hostile towards, scientific research suggesting that violent games have negative effects. One experiment even found that when subjects were told they were participating in a study on violent video games, those who considered themselves gamers were more likely to try to sabotage the results of a word completion task by suppressing responses that suggested violent thoughts. Those participants who did not see themselves as gamers didn't try to appear less prone to violent thoughts, nor did gamers when the purpose of the experiment was described in terms unrelated to the effects of violent video games. What do psychologists find when they carefully study the issue in an unbiased, controlled way? Do all those mainstream media stories report a causal link because that's what the evidence clearly shows? Are all those gamers justified in rolling their eyes and claiming it's nothing but another moral panic? If so much ink has been spilled and so many pixels have been lit up over the topic, surely we can look to science for a clear answer, right? Unfortunately, no. As we will see, views on the topic still vary widely among psychologists, even though they are usually, but not always, free of bombastic language and moral outrage. Conclusions on both sides of the debate are so weighted down by caveats and limitations that academic discussion of the effects of video game violence frequently turn to a discussion about the merits of the methods that are used in the research itself, and not the larger question of what spawned it.
And I think that, you know, very often we have not been very good at distinguishing between sort of the moral content issues versus the, you know, empirical database, you know, behavioral issues. And I think that's where you've seen, you know, people are, you know, doing these studies of video games where they're, you know, using noise blasts or ice water or whatever else. And that's interesting and important, but you're seeing this very quick generalization to, you know, again, whether it's true or not that, you know, video games make people put other people's hands on ice water more or not, the people saying that this says something about gun violence.
Hey everybody, just a quick break to remind you about my Patreon campaign. If you like this website and if you like the podcasts, then you can help me out to keep things going by throwing a buck or two my way at patreon.com/BOG. The support from the Patreon helps pay for hosting and other expenses related to the podcast and the website. And let's be honest, it keeps me on schedule and keeps me motivated to keep cranking these things out. So thank you to all of you who are Patreon supporters. I appreciate it. And if you're interested, like I said, you can go to patreon.com/POG. Thanks. And with that out of the way, let's get on to the interview. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining me on the interview portion of the podcast. My guest this episode is Chris Ferguson, who is here to talk with us about a topic that often shows up when you search for psychology and video games together, and that is the effects of video game violence on real-world behavior, in particular real-world violence. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on today.
So who are you and what are you doing here?
Yeah, that's always a good question. So yeah, my name is Chris Ferguson. I'm a associate professor of psychology at Stetson University. And I've been studying violent behavior for probably close to 15 years, and for maybe about the last 10 of those years, had a particular focus on issues of media violence and violence in video games specifically. So some of that was dovetailed in from a lot of the attention that had been put on to mass homicides and gun violence, and a lot of that was going on, particularly after the Columbine shooting in 1999. So that a lot of that sort of discussion is what kind of dovetailed me into this topic area. But that's what I've been doing really for the last 10 years or so.
And it sounds like there's a lot of research and a lot of discussion to be had. Your name seems to come up most often attached to counterpoints along the lines of no game. There's not a strong relationship, you think, between video game violence and real world violence. Like whenever there's a new meta-analysis, whenever the American Psychological Association puts out a new statement you tend to be heard from at those points. Is that fair to say?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, one of the odd things about this field is that actually, I think, you know, where we get the most attention in video game research is again, after these kind of like mass shootings or gun violence incidents and such. So, I mean, after the shooting in 2012 at Sandy Hook, that was really probably the most furious point where there were news, you know, there were journalists, news media calling all the time, trying to get some sort of insight into what the research said or did not say about, you know, video game violence and things like that. But yeah, there does seem to be this kind of like point, counterpoint sort of issue where, you get some individuals or groups like the APA that will make these types of claims. And then you certainly will find other scholars who, you know, are resistant or skeptical of those types of claims. And I guess from probably the perspective of news media, that's sort of good theater to some extent, is to kind of have the point counterpoint. But that's really different from, again, like, you know, even like 10 years ago or certainly 15, I think that discussion has changed or the culture has changed somewhat. And I think if you went back after Columbine, there really wasn't much of a counterpoint. I mean, there really was this idea that video games were bad in some way was really the dominant way of thinking. So over the past really 10 to 15 years, there's been a big shift in that now you are seeing a lot more of the discussion becoming things like, you know, point, counterpoint. And, you know, when groups like the APA, you know, occasionally release these statements blaming video games for problems in society, as they just did this past August, you are seeing a lot more pushback from, you know, some members of the scholarly community and such. So I think overall that's good. I mean, I think, you know, we really are dealing in a marketplace of ideas. And, you know, I think that a lot of the problems that had developed for video game research and a lot of other media research is that it really sort of existed in this echo chamber that, you know, there really was this kind of groupthink that was going on, and a lot of ideas are putting out there and being sold to the general public without being scrutinized more critically than they have been.
So let's kind of get into some of the psychology and the models and the science. And let me see if I can sort of briefly summarize sort of the yes, there's a relationship position, or at least one of some of the major models. And then you can tell me if I got that relatively right, and then we can take it from there. At least from what I've read from, you know, people like Brad Bushman, Craig Anderson, the general aggression model, you know, the idea is that when you see or play a violent video game, it sort of activates nodes in this mental network of relationships. So you might play a game and that activates the thought of shooting or stabbing or punching. And then those relationships or those activations of different nodes that are related to that, and you sort of get this cascading effect to where it makes you have violent thoughts or violent associations, or it makes those types of thoughts easier to access in memory, and maybe makes them more likely to be accessed in the face of an ambiguous situation, like a social situation. Over the long term, those sorts of activation of those thoughts and activating sort of mental scripts about how do I deal with, or what is the scripts, like the way that we deal with things and sort of the cascading ideas, those become habitual over time. And that can lead to even drastic things like changes in personality or putting ourselves more frequently into social situations where violence is a, you know, more acceptable or easier solution. And they become more easily accessible in those ambiguous social situations. And that sort of leads to the long-term effects of violent media on behavior and thoughts and personality. Am I in the ballpark, or am I in the generally right direction?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I mean, you know, theories like the general aggression model are very much social cognitive models, which is mm-hmm. basically what you're saying. They're sort of practice effects, types of models, and the sort of the activation of these cognitive scripts. So the idea is that, you know, we use these kind of mental heuristics to inform us about how to respond to different types of scenarios, and perhaps particularly, as you mentioned, when the scenarios are ambiguous. So if you're, I guess kind of like the cliche is, if you're a high school student, you're walking down the hall and someone bumps into you, you know, how do you interpret that sort of ambiguous event? Maybe it was an accident, or maybe this other person's being a jerk, right? You know, so the idea is, if you are playing a lot of violent video games or watching a lot of violent movies, or reading violent books. I mean, in fact, there's, you know, Brad Bushman has a study about the Bible, for instance, that suggests the Bible sort of does the same thing.
Pretty violent stories in the Bible, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is it doesn't really matter, what you're exposed to, but the fact that you're sort of rehearsing or practicing these types of aggressive scenarios forms over time more and more of these types of cognitive associations. And then when you are in a situation where you are asked to evaluate ambiguous stimuli, because you've been practicing these kind of aggressive responses, you're more likely to interpret ambiguous stimuli as aggressive as opposed to accidental, and respond to it with aggressive behavior. Because again, that's what you've either been seeing in TV or reading in books, or have been practicing yourself through the actions of a video game. So it is in many cases sort of a monkey see, monkey do type of approach. The idea is that without you being aware of it, without you wanting it necessarily, without you being able to control it, your brain develops to, is rehearsing these types of associations and eventually these types of behaviors, and makes you in a pretty, clear causal direction, makes you more likely to engage in the exact same types of behaviors as you're rehearsing in a video game or in a movie, television show, whatever, whatever else. Now, the models may allow for maybe some individuals are more influenced than others. Perhaps if you have pre-existing mental health conditions or things like that, you may be more vulnerable. But generally, these models, suggest that really sort of all of us, no matter how functional otherwise or whatever backgrounds we may come from, all of us are influenced by these types of media or games or even just a picture of a gun. It really doesn't require much. We're all influenced in the same direction, and also it doesn't really tend to matter. Things like graphicness. So people tend to think of a violent video game when we use that term being like the Grand Theft Auto or Call of Duty, types of series. But theoretically, at least the way that, sort of violent media is defined and the way it's sort of studied and the way that these models are developed, that even a game like playing Asteroids, ought to cause the same types of effects, or Pac-Man or things like that. As long as there is some form of aggression in the game, that is going to cause the same sort of rehearsal process.
Yeah, that seems to be a comment that comes up a lot. It's like, where do you draw the line between, cartoon violence and graphic, realistic, believable violence? And, is something like Mario, where you're stomping on little creatures, considered violent in the same way that something like, Manhunt or Postal or Grand Theft Auto is considered violent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some respects, I mean, the whole concept that we're talking about, this idea of violent video games, is really a terrible concept, in the sense that we're really lumping together a lot of different media into one category and assuming that, by simple virtue of being in this category, that all these media have the same type of effect. So I mean, the example would be out of literature. If you were to combine the Bible and the Hindu Ramayana in with Stephen King, in with Shakespeare, in with comic books and Harry Potter, and sort of lump all that together as violent media, which it technically is. All these books I mentioned have violence in them. We think of these things as being violent media and assume that they all have the same effect on people. And maybe they do or maybe they don't. But I think from the way that, most people think of literature or movies or video games, to kind of toss these things in all together into one conceptual space and assume that that label means something. I think, most people would find that to be problematic. And certainly even from a scientific perspective, I find that to be quite problematic to see that kind of, omnibus label being put on a really a heterogeneous category, group of different stimuli. And of course, it's also just the fact that, if you look at the literature, for instance, you see some of the same games being studied for two different reasons. So you see these first-person shooter or third-person shooter sort of action shooter games being studied for aggression and violence on one side, but they're also being studied for the idea that they can improve attention and visual spatial cognition and, in some ways, essentially make you better surgeons or engineers and things like that. And it's funny because when you see the games studied for aggression, they're called violent video games. When you see the exact same studies or
Called
exact same
action,
video
yeah.
game, they're called action games when you talk about the visual, spatial cognition and such. So you can see that to some extent that's kind of sketchy. Yeah, I mean, the scientists are kind of manipulating the label to some extent, depending upon what they want you to think about them. And granted, that may be the scholars on both sides. that are doing that. But that's a, you know, I think in some senses that's a bit of a flag for some of the cultural issues within the field that may be a problem.
Okay. So before we go too far down that road, I want to get back to talking about the, you know, like the general aggression model. There's been research, some evidence for parts of that model to show, for example, that if you have somebody play a violent game and then somebody else play a nonviolent game or no game, that there will be differences between those people or those groups of people in terms of how easily or how quickly they come up with violent thoughts or associations between words. Some of the studies might have like word completion exercises where they'll have two groups of people, one that played a violent game, one that didn't, and give them a word like EXPLO blank E. And one group will come up with explode and the other group will come up with explore, for example. And the argument is that, okay, the violent game primed that person to have violent thoughts or easier access to violent concepts. Other experiments might have a study where they gave them the beginning of a story and they said, okay, tell us how the story ends. And the people that played violent games were more likely to come up with, you know, violence or harm as part of that story. So there does seem to be some evidence there. What's your reaction to that, or how much should we read into that? Or
yeah, that's a great question. So I mean, I think with the experimental studies, you know, when they bring people into the lab to randomize them to be exposed either to what they're calling a violent video game or a nonviolent video game, there really are like three sort of broad categories, or maybe four sort of broad categories of things that people are looking at. But really, it comes down to sort of, you know, affect and how people feel, cognitions and what they're thinking, which is kind of what you're describing with the word association tasks and such. And then, of course, you know, different types of behaviors. People sometimes will try to get some sense of whether, you know, mildly aggressive behaviors are increased after playing a violent video game. So you know, the types of things that you're describing with the sort of like word associate or, you know, word fill in the blank, you know, type of tasks, are these sort of cognitive association tasks. Now, they tend to get, you know, sort of relabeled as aggressive thoughts. And that, again, in some ways is a misnomer. And I think, you know, a somewhat devious misnomer. And that what you're really talking about is just sort of associations, what people are thinking about, you know. When you talk about like aggressive thoughts, I think that tends to come across to the general public and to scholars as if these people are motivated to engage in aggression. And these types of associations have really nothing to do with motivation. It's not that these people are thinking like, wow, I'd love to go beat somebody up. And that's not the type of aggressive thoughts that we're talking about with these types of tasks. You're really looking at sort of like what, you know, cognitive schema are currently active in an individual. And I think that when you look at these, you know, different categories of outcomes, affective, you know, versus cognitive versus behavioral, I think probably the sort of strongest evidence is for there being some form of sort of, you know, immediate cognitive association that is going on. But on the other hand, I don't think that's terribly surprising. I mean, what you're basically saying is that people are still thinking about the thing that they just did. And I think that you could find that kind of
That sort of takes the wind out of the argument, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you're seeing is that people still think about, you know, what they just experienced, which is not, you know, terribly surprising. And I think you could find that with almost anything. And sort of the example I sometimes use is that I think if you took, you know, men who identified as being heterosexual, and you expose some of them to watch, you know, a movie like Brokeback Mountain, where there are a lot of homosexual, you know, themes in that movie, or you randomize some other men to watch another movie that, you know, was perhaps a more heterocentric, you know, type of romance movie or whatever. I think you could find a cognitive association type of link that the men who just watched Brokeback Mountain would come out and they would be able to associate quicker, you know, words that had homosexual types of themes or overtones or whatever, than the men who had come out of a more, you know, heterocentric, you know, romance movie. Does that mean that they're more likely to engage in gay sex, you know, however? You know, I don't think so. And I think if you put it in that context, you know, politically even, you know, I think people are moving away from this idea that, you know, sexual orientation is something we have much control over.
Right.
And so the idea that our sexual orientation would be so easily primed by watching a movie, I think most people would find to be ridiculous.
But at the same, I was going to say at the same time, something like violence is more easily influenced by your environment and what's going on in your head. I mean, I think the Brokeback Mountain point is illustrative and it makes a good point, but the question is still, does repeated, you know, exposure to this sort of stuff and repeated activation of those ideas and concepts and strengthening of those relationships have a long-term effect?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that really is kind of the question that we're looking at. And so the question is, do these types of, you know, short-term cognitive associations, you know, really sort of generalize into anything else that means anything in sort of the real world environment? And I think that that's where the evidence is, you know, very, very slim. I mean, you talk about like the idea that there are environmental inputs onto, you know, violent behavior. I mean, I certainly think that that is, you know, that is true. But we have to think about like what types of environmental inputs have that kind of influence. And I think that, you know, we have to be careful of assuming that the types of exposures that people have in their real lives, you know, whether they've been abused or neglected by their parents, have the same types of impact on us as watching things in, you know, a fictional movie or a video game or things like that. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's an area where the field has not been very specific in terms of making those types of distinctions. In fact, really quite the opposite. I mean, we have had scholars say that in effect, you know, and it is really kind of part of the gam, really, is that this idea that whether we're watching a movie or experiencing violence in our real lives doesn't make a difference, and that our brains respond the same exact way, you know, to these types of stimuli. And that's where I think that the evidence is actually quite weak for there being any type of sort of cumulative, long-term, you know, effect from these types of exposures to violent video games. Or I don't think there's any evidence that these, you know, short-term sort of cognitive effects that probably do happen really mean anything for the long term. I don't think that they stick.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of longitudinal studies or looking at that piece of the model that goes from, okay, here's the short-term effects, and then in aggregate they create these long-term effects. Just in my own review of the literature, I didn't see a lot of that. And in fact, some of the meta-analyses that had been done, once you took into account things like exposure to violence in the home or being male, for example, which is a risk factor for violence, that the effects of violent media actually either went away or became vanishingly small.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there probably have been about, you know, somewhere around a dozen longitudinal studies. So that's quite a bit better than it had been even 10 years ago. And I think, you know, they all get packaged differently depending upon who did them, right? So there's also the sort of packaging effect you see with a lot of science. But, you know, if you really sort of look across them, you do see exactly what you're describing, that you do tend to find small correlations between, you know, playing violent video games and, you know, aggressive behavior, however we're defining that. But those correlations tend to be very small. Like in the, I think about like the correlational coefficient about 0.14. Once you control for things like male gender, and even in longitudinal studies, sort of prior aggressiveness, if you have sort of what we call like time one aggressiveness, that really those correlation coefficients drop to something much closer to zero, very, very close to nothing, maybe like a 0.06 or a 0.07 type of correlation. So it really doesn't require even controlling for much, you know, even just two variables really wipes away most of the explanatory power of, you know, violent video game playing on later aggression. And certainly, as you're saying, once you start to control for other things like family environment, personality, you know, things even become, you know, really, you know, sketchier. The one thing that'd be sort of interesting too to control for would be really sort of like biology and genetics and things like that. And there really are no studies in video games that control for those things. The only kind of hint that we have on that issue is a study by Joe Schwartz and Kevin Beaver that was very, very recent, where they looked at television violence and, you know, found that there, again, are these sort of small correlations between television violence and later they looked at adult antisocial behavior. So they found these small correlations. But once you control for genes, you know, sort of behavioral genetics, those correlations vanish, basically. So it even suggests that there is sort of this maturational process, this sort of, you know, biological genetically hardwired process that we really need to consider when we're really thinking about links between media and behavior. But it's very difficult to control for those because, of course, these genetic experiments are quite expensive.
Yeah, that's both incredibly interesting and incredibly terrifying at the same time, you know, to think about somebody could do a cheek swab on you and then sort of have an idea of like what shows you should or shouldn't watch or what types of games you should or shouldn't play.
Right. Yeah.
So I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier and ask about the difference between violence and aggression. And mm-hmm. I see those terms used what seems to be interchangeably a lot. And what is the difference, or is there a difference?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there definitely is a difference, and it's really kind of like one of these, you know, A equals B, but B doesn't equal A type of logic, you know, problem. So yeah, we probably would say that, you know, violent behaviors and generally are aggressive, but that not all aggressive behaviors are violent. In essence, and again, you do see, unfortunately, the terms used fairly interchangeably. And my casual observation is the interchangeability of those terms becomes more pronounced the more society is worried about, you know, mass shootings and gun violence and things like that. But you do find these studies that, you know, bring people into the lab and have them play video games for 15 minutes and then have them measure aggression in terms of something like a noise burst or something of that sort. And then they sort of say, you know, we did this study and found that video game players are more likely to give people a louder burst of noise on their headphones, just like mass shooters, you know, who have, you know, played violent video games. You do tend to find these kind of, you know, tendentious, you know, wordings in some of these studies where people are obviously trying to apply, you know, the aggressive behaviors that we're studying in the lab to these, you know, horrible acts of violence in, you know, in society. And Patrick Markey, who's a scholar at Villanova, even has an article where he has like a list of these, you know, quotes, you know, from scholars and politicians and everybody else making these types of leaps of logic. But aggressive behavior, you know, is basically defined as any kind of behavior that is intended to cause harm to another person, where that other person would want to avoid that harm. Mm-hmm. So pretty simple definition. And that doesn't mean it has to be physical. It could be, you know, verbal, you know, you're insulting someone.
Right.
Spreading lies about them, evaluating them negatively because you're resentful of something they did. You know, so if, you know, theoretically you go to a restaurant and you have service you think is negative and you leave a bad tip, that would be aggressive. You know, for instance, you're doing something harmful to a person that other person would likely wish to avoid, you know. So we can see from that, you know, type of example that, you know, a lot of aggressive behaviors are not violent. They're not criminal. They're not even unusual, you know, necessarily. You know, they're things that, you know, probably most of us or all of us do on some level and may feel justified in doing, you know, some of these. You know, types of behaviors. Some aggressive behaviors are adaptive, you know, so defending yourself, you know, against another person, whether that's physical or verbal, you know, would be aggressive. You know, so I think when we think about aggressive behavior, there is still this kind of like moralizing tone to it, you know, the idea, and coming certainly out of the social science, there is this sort of vibe that aggressive behavior is always bad. And that we always want to decrease people's aggressive behavior. And to some extent, you know, obviously some aggressive behaviors are bad, but some are adaptive too. And we haven't really been very good about making a distinction between sort of the levels of aggressiveness or assertiveness, which, you know, in some ways is just aggressive behavior that's, you know, we consider to be fine.
Yeah, I was just going to make that distinction between aggressiveness and assertiveness and ask whether that had been examined at all.
Not very effectively, you know, not really. I mean, there's sort of this idea that assertive behavior is stuff where you're sort of, you know, looking out for yourself, but in a way that is socially desirable. But in many cases, again, it's one of these sort of A equals B, but B equals not, doesn't equal A. You know, again, sort of, you know, probably most assertive behaviors are aggressive in a way.
Yeah, I'm sketching out some Venn diagrams as we talk here.
Yeah, we definitely need the Venn diagrams to be in position here. So again, if someone says something that is, you know, I don't like the work that you've done, and you come back and say, well, I actually think it's good, and here's why. I mean, it's a fairly minor thing, right? But you're in some ways trying to assert your dominance over this other person who has offended you or insulted you. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it still comes at a cost to them. You know, potentially, and which would make it still, you know, aggressive. So I think, you know, we in some ways still haven't really quite hammered out the exact parameters of what it is that we are trying to study here. So for example, in a lot of the laboratory experiments, it's important to realize that the behaviors people are being asked to do, they're being essentially, you know, told or implied are okay. Because they're told that, you know, for instance, with, you know, giving someone a burst of white noise, they're being told that they're playing a reaction time game against another person, and these bursts of white noise are part of the game. So you have an authority figure who's basically telling them that it's okay to do this.
Yeah.
And that's different, I think, from the types of aggressive behaviors that we're really interested in. You know, we're really interested in maladaptive aggressive behaviors, you know, things that people do that actually cause themselves, you know, some sort of response cost, or that we think are of as being socially undesirable.
So what do you mean by response costs there?
Well, I mean, a good example might be like, let's imagine you're playing a game of cards against, you know, a couple friends, right? And you lose. And we've all seen examples of this, right? That, you know, people sometimes when they lose, they get pissed off and they get aggressive and they
flipping tables. And
yeah, they flip the table or throw the cards across the room, right? So that's aggressive behavior. It's not necessarily violent because you didn't, you know, cause physical injury to another human being, but it is aggressive behavior. You know, and it is going to come at a response cost, right? Because these other people are going to want to play with you less, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and that would be something that we would think of as being an aggressive behavior that is maladaptive, right? It's, you know, you responded in a way aggressively that didn't do you any good, and it didn't do anybody else any good.
Sort of has social capital costs associated
with
it.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of a cost for everybody. And I think if you're talking about behaviors like that, then I think, you know, most of us would agree that, yeah, it'd be nice if there are fewer of these things, right? You know, that we want people to do less of that. If you're talking about someone saying, you know what, I'm just going to pick a random politician. I think Hillary Clinton ought to be president. And I'm just picking her randomly, by the way. I'm not trying to make a political statement here. And you believe that, you know, Jeb Bush ought to be president. And you say, you know what, I disagree with you, and here's why. And I think Hillary would be a horrible president, you know. You're still potentially, you know, engaging in at least some sort of like very mildly aggressiveness, you know, toward this other person. But I also think that we appreciate that type of conversation, as long as it's kept in some degree of balance, right, is a good thing. I mean, we're mm-hmm. not, you know, going to want to tell people that they should never stick up for their beliefs, even in ways that may challenge another person's perspective and perhaps, you know, come at a response cost for that other person.
So I guess to add an additional wrinkle to it, some of that stuff may be culture bound as well. Some cultures may appreciate that, and some cultures may apply a higher cost.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there certainly are very, you know, situation specific, you know, types of, you know, contextual variables as well. So that sort of thing is probably okay as long as you're in a sports bar somewhere, but, you know, sort of bursting into that conversation at church is probably bad.
Right.
You know, so again, you know, as
we're
long
talking
as
about religion in a sports bar or vice versa.
Yeah. All of those things, you know, together could be, or any of those things at the dinner table over at Thanksgiving could be very, very bad as well. So, you know, I think that the parameters of what we're studying and how we're studying it and what we're generalizing it to are still very squishy, mm-hmm. Really. So we're taking these types of behaviors in the lab, you know, whether it's sort of like the noise blast competitive reaction time test, or the, you know, sort of ice water bucket, you know, test, or the hot sauce test, that kind of stuff. In each of these cases, you know, people are being told essentially it's okay for you to engage in this behavior by someone who's an authority figure. And so you're kind of normalizing the behavior, but then we're taking the, and it's not to say that those, you know, types of outcomes aren't interesting, but then we're seeing a lot of studies taking that and applying it to these types of, you know, you get bumped in a hall and you explode, you know, because you interpret this ambiguous stimuli as more negative. And I'm not so sure that we have the grounds to make that type of generalization. You know, whether or not those studies are even consistent, even if we were to say that they were, I still think we're being very, very risky in the way that we're generalizing, you know, those types of behaviors we're studying in the lab to the real world.
So the violence versus aggression topic also, you know, opens the door or leads to what has been popular or hot topic in gaming culture, and that is like toxic behavior and, you know, online harassment, especially against women and minorities. that does seem like something that you see come up in video games a lot and certain types of games. It's the sort of thing where I look at and I say, you know, come on, people. I wish there was more research on this. The link between mass shootings and video games is important, and I think research should happen. But, man, here's something that happens constantly every day, and it is picking up some. You are starting to see more research address, you know, harassment, and there are people in the games industry doing lots of research on toxic behavior. Mm-hmm. But I guess I wish it were being studied with as much fervor and attention as other topics.
Yeah, and I think it will be in the near future. I mean, the reality is that, you know, scholars tend to follow the bouncing ball, to some extent, and you know, for a couple of decades, really, the conversation really in society had been on violence and the link between violence and media and societal violence. And so that's where all the money was, that's where all the news headlines were, and so on and so forth. And you know, scholars aren't dumb. You know, they kind of follow, they're like water, they go downhill and follow the least resistant path.
And the grant money. Yeah.
And the grant money. Yeah. That's really the political prestige, the newspaper headlines, and the grant money are kind of like the three things that are motivators for certainly a lot of scholars.
Sure.
And groups like the American Psychological Association. But I think now we are seeing a lot more attention to, really, there are two issues that are interesting to me as far as, you know, sort of like gender in particular in gaming. There's one, there is the sort of harassment that we're seeing of women gamers, women developers, women games journalists, and so on and so forth, you know, where they're having to put up with, all kinds of, sexist comments, you know, threats of violence, threats of rape, and things like that. Which are absolutely, astounding, to hear about. On the other hand, there's also the issue of the way that women or female characters are represented in video games. So the idea of sort of like the chainmail bikini sort of phenomenon, right? That there's a sexualization of female characters in video games, women are presented as damsels in distress, and they're particularly in certain genres of games, there are relatively few female protagonists who are non-sexualized, and I think that's getting, both those issues are kind of related to each other, and I think both are getting are going to see some more research and more attention in the coming years, in part because they're getting more societal attention and more news media attention, and I think this is, in some respects, again, this is nothing that's isolated about video games. I mean, I think there's a wider societal conversation about, you know, sexism in society, misogyny in society, and the way that women, particularly women in the public eye, are being treated. And I think in many respects, for women who are in the public eye, I think things have gotten, in some ways worse for them because of the anonymity of the internet and the ease with which people can make threats and not suffer any consequences.
Just let me add, it's a little bit of a tangent from the topic at hand, but do you think that the same sort of models can apply to predicting or understanding violent behavior and to understanding misogynistic and other types of harassment or toxic behavior? You know, because I often get the question, you say, well, you say that violent games don't create violence, but then how can you also say that games that treat women in a certain way, for example, cause players to inherit those values and those opinions, and then in turn treat women in the same way, that you're arguing for a causal link in one but not the other, and how do you reconcile that difference? I'm not necessarily saying you say that, but I do hear those conversations happening.
I'm actually not saying that there's a causal connection even here between content and behavior necessarily. But that's sort of the all have one and must have prizes sort of hypothesis. You know, the idea that if something can have one effect, then it must have every other single possible effect that we can think of as well. And the answer to that really is that that's just not how things work. I mean, that's just not how science happens. That, if we can say X causes Y, and in our imagination, we can also imagine that it might cause Z and W and T and U as well. Just because you can imagine doesn't mean it's true. And each of these effects need to be studied individually. We can't just assume that, I mean, we usually see it in the context of sort of positive effects. So, if we were to believe, for instance, that first person shooter games make you a better surgeon or a better engineer or things like that. And I'm not even, I'm not really endorsing that view either, but let's imagine that were true. And there were this sort of this research suggesting that playing shooter games made you better in terms of attention or visual spatial cognition. well, why can't they make you into a better criminal, you know, sort of assaultive, you know, violent person as well? Well, the reality is that these are two different outcomes, and it's entirely possible that video games may have one effect, but not the others. You know, so you have to study these things on individual levels. You can't make these types of assumptions that, you know, media will have two, you know, very different outcomes, even if they seem related in some sort of superficial.
I really like the idea of gifted surgeon by day, roughneck by night, you know, person that grew up playing video games.
It's kind of like the, you know, what would be Christian Bale in American Psycho sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're both as gifted, you know, I forget what he was, a lawyer, a business person or whatever, you know, but also an incredibly antisocial person at the same time. Yeah. You know, so all of these types of hypotheses, it's fine to raise these hypotheses, but all of them need to be evidence-based. And if the evidence leads us in one direction but not the other one, then that's kind of just how things, you know, pan out. I mean, one of the things you hear a lot about is, and it's a very facetious argument, but the argument is sort of like, if advertisers spend billions of dollars a year trying to get you to buy Coke instead of Pepsi, why can't violent video games turn you into a, you know, a violent criminal?
I hear that one a lot too.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm making that a little bit facetious, but I mean, that's essentially the gist of that sort of argument. And you really think about it, first off, you're talking about two different forms of media, you know, one that is fictional, one that is also probably fictional, but pretends not to be. You know, advertising at least pretends to be truthful, or at least pretends to be informational. So right there, our brains are going to process these two different media very differently from each other. But you're also talking about very, very different behavioral outcomes. The leap between, for advertisement to be effective, it doesn't need to get you to like soda. It just needs to get you to switch from Pepsi to Coke. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is lucrative. It's a relatively tiny behavioral change that it's trying to get you to make, or even not even switch, but to remain loyal to Coke, you know, if you already were drinking it. That's very different from turning you into a pacifist, you know, from a pacifist into, you know, someone who's beating people up in the high school halls and things like that. So, I mean, these really were these apples and oranges types of comparison. So, you know, before we head down this road of, well, if I can show one effect, why can't every other effect also be true? We have to imagine that is not a very good scientific argument for why effects should, you know, possibly happen. And I really do think, and if I'm allowed, you know, somewhat of, you know, hard words, I think it's a shame when I've seen some scholars make that type of argument themselves, because they should know better. That just has no, that makes no, you know, in terms of actual logic, it's not logically appropriate.
Well, to be fair, I don't see it often from scholars, but I do see, you know, in the places where people are discussing video games and violence and all of these topics, it does come up by people who are, you know, usually clear thinking. And I think the fact that they're asking the question probably shows some sort of, you know, willingness to think deeply about the topics.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I have seen a few scholars make it, but yeah, I mean, one would hope that, you know, for the most part, the scholarly community would avoid that type of logic. But yeah, I do think, you know, coming back to your original question of, you know, sort of like the models. I mean, I suspect you will see social cognitive models applied to this issue of women and representations of female characters or sexism in gaming and such. But you know, and again, even as much as I think this is a serious issue, and certainly on a moral level, I would love to see better representations of women in games, and I do think this is a content issue in the sense of it simply being a shame that there isn't a, you know, better diversity of character or better representation of female characters in video games. But we have to, you know, separate out. I mean, just because, you know, morally I'm opposed to the way that the video game industry is kind of doing things, particularly in the shooter genre, doesn't mean that causally there's a public health issue there. So, and I think that's where, you know, we've very often gone off the rails with a lot of issues with media, is that there's a lot of offensive content in media, wherever you're talking about, whether it's television, books, you know, whether it's sexual or violent or language and such. There's plenty of offensive content out there, racist stuff, you know, whatever. And, you know, we can be opposed to that stuff on a moral level, but that doesn't mean that this stuff is a public health threat necessarily. It doesn't mean that there's a causal connection between this material and behavior changing down the there may be, but that's an empirical question. And I think that, you know, very often we have not been very good at distinguishing between sort of like the moral content issues versus the, you know, empirical data-based, you know, behavioral issues. And I think that's where you've seen, you know, people are, you know, doing these studies of video games where they're, you know, using noise blasts or ice water or whatever else. And that's interesting and important, but you're seeing there's a very quick generalization to, again, whether it's true or not that, video games make people put other people's hands on ice water more or not, the people saying that this says something about gun violence, and this is important, and this is a public health threat and stuff. And that very, very clear jump, from relatively minor pieces of data into a public health threat, I think, again, reflects the moral salience of a lot of these issues. And that's the thing I worry about, going into, and I'm interested in doing some research on sort of, this issue of gender and the way that women are represented in video games as well. I mean, I think that we have to be careful and learn from, number of mistakes that were made in the violent video game research literature that we have to understand going in, this is an emotional issue. I mean, misogyny and sexism is being discussed at the societal level now. It's a political issue. It's a social issue. It's a moral issue. And as we begin to do research, particularly as, a relatively homogenous group of human beings who, that being social scientists, who come with a certain amount of political baggage to begin with, that we have to remember that the temptation to make this into a moral issue is going to be there, And we have to be careful that it may very well end up being that this type of content is bad, in a public health way. But we have to make sure that as much as possible, as humanly possible, that we're shielding our moral beliefs about this issue from the way that we ask questions in science, the way that we collect data, the way that we analyze data, and the way that we communicate that data to the general public.
Yeah, science as a method of inquiry should be amoral. Like, it shouldn't care about your political leanings or your social leanings. It's, what do the data say? But
yeah,
but
I take your point.
that's hard to do a lot of times.
Yeah.
So that all being said, let me throw you kind of a gotcha question.
Sure.
If we take it that, there's not a strong link between violent games and violent behavior, I still don't let my kids, my young kids, both of them pre-teenage, play really violent games. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong to do that, or am I being unnecessarily restrictive in doing that?
It really depends on why you're doing it. That's a great question. Actually, you have to have a better gotcha question. I get that question all the time. usually the gotcha version of it is usually people ask me, because I have a 12-year-old son, so they're like, would you let your child play Grand Theft Auto Sure. 5? That's kind of the question.
Are you a monster, Chris Ferguson?
the idea of this question is, of course, that however you answer it, you lose, right? That's the wonderful, gotcha element of it. But I think that this comes back to, what I was just saying, that, there's a moral issue and there is a, sort of causal public health issue. And as long as you know why you're making the choices that you are making, then I think it's fine to be restrictive. And I think that, I'll give an example myself. I mean, I'll be upfront and say that, in our family, we are fairly permissive, in terms of my son's, media exposure. And such. But what we tend to do is we tend to screen, if something's like an R-rated movie or an M-rated video game, that's clearly designed for adults, in mind, that usually we'll screen it. My wife or I will screen either the game or the movie. Usually if it's a game, it's going to be me. We'll screen it first and decide if we're comfortable with the content. And of course, even with M-rated games or R-rated movies, they're not all the same, right? So, as an example, my son loves the movie Prometheus,
And I'm sorry.
Yeah. don't hold it against
me. Well, he's young. Prometheus
fan. Yeah. we watched it and it was just like, it's alien squids and, sure. So we thought it really wasn't that big a deal. And so we let him watch it and such. But by contrast, I just went with a friend yesterday to see The Hateful Eight.
I haven't seen that.
So he likes Westerns. He likes, he likes shoot 'em up types of films. And I don't know if you've seen The Hateful Eight.
No, but it's Quentin Tarantino, so that tells you a lot.
But even for, okay, so I'm not going to, throw out any spoilers or anything, but even for a Quentin Tarantino movie, this is, it is above the level of Django Unchained. Let's put it that way, okay. In terms of, the content that you would probably consider that you would not want your preteen, children to, be exposed to. A lot of awkward conversations, let's put it that way. Obviously, after seeing it, I'm like, I'm not going to take my son to see the Hateful Eight. But it's not because I think that taking my son to see a movie like The Hateful Eight would turn him into whatever, more violent, more sexist because there are a lot of scenes where, you know, there's some violence towards women in the movie. Mm-hmm. I don't really think the movie would change him and make him, you know, like women less or be more aggressive towards them or be more aggressive as a human being. But it's just not made for kids. You know what I mean? It's just not made for the 12-year-old audience. And like I said, there'd be, you know, awkward conversations and just content that, you know, is not made to share between, you know, parents and their 12-year-old kids and that kind of stuff. So on a moral level, I would say, you know, some of these scenes are stuff that I'm just morally uncomfortable exposing. It just makes me feel icky, you know, and it doesn't really require anything else as far as I'm concerned as a parent. If I'm made to feel icky about it, then that's good enough for me. I don't need to be told that it's going to make my son into a serial murderer or, you know, a woman-hating abuser or things like that. I don't need causal effects,
right?
You know, to be there.
One of the message board communities that I participate in, somebody recently started a thread saying that they were basically done with violent media. Mm-hmm. And it happened because their feelings about gun violence, specifically in America, with recent events in the last few months, just kind of pushed them to the point where, like, I'm sick of glorifying and fetishizing gun violence in all its forms. And so they said, for me and my house and my kids, you know, we're not going to play any more violent games where gunplay is a factor. And it was interesting because the person said explicitly, like, I know what the research says about the relationship between video game violence and real world violence and all the things that we've been talking about. But he said, for me, it's just more of a moral, a values-based decision to omit that from our lives. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really interesting comment. It's not something I wouldn't want to go that far in my own life, or at least I'm not to that point yet. And everybody is different and has different life experiences. But I thought it was really interesting that they made that distinction between, like, this is not me saving anyone from anything. It's me just expressing my values and my disgust around some of these things that have happened and the way that culture is glorifying them or valuing them.
And I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, I think, you know, again, as long as we're clear, you know, one, that we're making a moral decision, and two, that we're making a decision for ourselves or our families, then I think that's, you know, absolutely fine. And I would support this person.
So if you had $1 million and a small army of graduate students, what kind of research program would you start up to take this field, you know, this topic to the next level and get it at least going in the direction where you want it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've really been thinking about this sort of issue for years, really, at this point. And sort of the building the better, you know, mousetrap. And there really are, if I really came down to really having unlimited resources, you really said you could offer me like $100 million, okay, then I could really do something.
Six trillion dollars. That's the best I can do.
All of the NSS funding comes directly to me. That would be fantastic.
One aircraft carrier's worth of funding.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, and one thing that sort of occurs to me is that, you know, particularly thinking of like the experimental studies of aggressive behavior or whatever else we're studying as an outcome, they're really very artificial, you know, and the way that people are playing games in the laboratory is very different from how they play games in real life. You know, so people are brought into the laboratory and they're randomized to play either a violent or a nonviolent game, or there may be some subset of games. You know, in most studies, they play alone. You know, there are some studies where they do look at like competition versus cooperation and such, but most of the studies they play alone for a very brief amount of time, 15 minutes or 20 minutes is fairly typical in most aggression studies. And then they're measured on some sort of, you know, behavior, and we don't necessarily even know what the behavior means, you know, in particular. So it's very different from, you know, so one, you know, people aren't getting to choose the game they're playing, you know, and that's, you know, for an experiment. And of course that makes sense, right? We need to randomize people to, you know, different groups. But even that fact that you're randomizing people to play a game they might not choose to play in real life, and may have had no prior exposure to, is going to introduce, I think, certain types of artifacts into, you know, the situation. There, for instance, was an interesting study out of Oxford University by a scholar by the name of Andy Shabilsky, that, you know, found that frustration in games, not violent content, but frustration, you know, tends to increase aggression. But so if you think about a lot of these experiments where you bring people in to play 15 minutes, is a game they might not have chosen to play in the first place. they might not even know how to work the controllers yet. And then 15 minutes, you whisk the controller out of their hands and say, hey, do you feel aggressive? Well, they might, you know. you know, and it might have nothing to do with the content of the video game. It really is sort of an artifact of the situation you set up for them. You know, you're kind of shooting fish in a barrel to some extent, and then ascribing it to the wrong thing. So, I mean, if you really had a lot of money and time and all these types of resources really weren't an issue, it'd be wonderful to you know, set up contrast in the lab still, because, you know, it still needs to be an experiment. You could set things up to be a lot more naturalistic than they are in most of these studies. So, you know, you can still have the randomized group. So you still bring some people in, have them play for 20 minutes, you know, at a game they're exposed to. So you still have those baselines, but you can also bring some people in and actually have 100 games lined up and say, you know, play whichever one you want for as long as you want, and see how that, you know, goes. Obviously, on a practical level, the way that, you know, funding works now, that can never happen. But if you give people, you know, choice in what games they play, give them an environment that looks natural where they can play with other people, so it has that social context that most gaming does, if that's how they want to play, and then also get a sense of what their motivations are. I mean, we don't really do enough motivational research in games and trying to understand why people are playing the games that they are. So it would really be fascinating, and I'm painting with broad strokes because I haven't obviously figured out all the nuts and bolts of this sort of, you know, how this would work, but it would really be fascinating to, you know, be able to study people in the lab where time and money wasn't an issue, allow them to pick games that they would want to play, you know, try to get some sense, maybe through surveys or whatever else, of why they chose the game, what they expected to get out of it. You know, let them play as long as they wanted, so it's a more naturalistic, you know, type of play setting. Let them play socially or alone, depending on what they wanted to do. You know, and then have some sort of aggressive behavior. So I think I've thought about the outcome too, you know, and find some way of measuring mild aggressive behavior that is more, you know, valid, I guess, you know, ecologically, you know, valid. I mean, again, the problem with a lot of aggressive behavior outcomes is that they're told that they can do this thing. So it'd be kind of neat to have something embedded in the experiment where people sort of subtly have the opportunity to be mildly aggressive towards another person. Mm-hmm. And it's not even clear that it was ever part of the experiment. You know what I mean? It's something, you know, nobody ever gave them the instruction that they could do or not do this thing. It just happened to be laying there.
On the way out from the
experiment. Yeah, yeah, kind of laying out there. And if the person, you know, thinks that nobody's looking, do they do it? You know, kind of a thing. And it might even be something like, you know, there's one Mario game where you could like to steal stars from, you know, your opponent.
Mario Party.
Like, yeah, I think so. You know, that's probably not a great example, but I'm thinking of things like that where you could do something that's sort of normative in the social context. That actually is the outcome, but it looks like it's just sort of a normal part of the, you know, the social context that the person is in, and that maybe people aren't even looking, you know. Like I said, I haven't figured out the nuts and bolts of how to make that work, but it'd be kind of cool if you could get kind of aggressive behaviors that were more like that, where there wasn't this kind of official experiment or sanction for the behavior.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about games that end friendships and cause violent thoughts. You know, Mario Party and Mario Kart would probably be something good to work in.
Yeah.
To your research program.
I've always heard, I've honestly never played either one, but I've always heard that those games are, yeah, exactly, like I said, you know, very aggression, friendship ending, inspiring games, and everybody seems to loathe them, but still play them for some reason or another. So I mean, I think that, you know, if you could design something like a lab that worked on that level, I think it would be fascinating, you know, and still have like the randomized controls, that's fine. But I'd be kind of curious if you kind of like let people play the way they actually play in real life, you know, and get a sense of their motivations. I think that would be fascinating because I think the other thing too is we kind of have this assumption, again, it's what comes out of social cognitive theory, is that, you know, there's this kind of clear link between content and behavior and everybody's kind of influenced the same way. You know, there may be moderators or mediators or things like that, but for the most part, there's this kind of like direct path between content and behavior. And I think that, you know, what probably is closer to the truth in my you know, hypothesis or my guess is that, you know, different people respond very differently to the same media or different media based on who they are, what their motivations are, and what they're coming from, you know, and what they want to get out of the media. You know, and I sometimes use the example of the Bible or any other religious text, you know, that, you know, a lot of them, you know, like the Bible does have violence in it, so it is violent media, but You know, a lot of people come to that because they want to learn how to be better people. A lot of people want to come to it because they want to learn how to, you know, calm themselves because they're going through a difficult period in life. Mm-hmm. Some people come to the Bible because they want to learn how to love others or give back to society. But other people come to the Bible because they want to have justification for hating people that are different from them. You know, so different people come to the same media with different motivations and get different things out of it. And I think that if you could find some sort of experimental paradigm to actually look at that, that interaction between people's personalities, their motivations, their choices in media, you know, and really respecting the fact that people are not randomly exposed to violent movies or violent video games, but choose, as the person you were talking to on that forum, you know, make choices about what they're going to be exposed to. If you can sort of wrap that into an experimental paradigm, which would probably be costly both in terms of time and money, I think that'd be incredibly, you know, fascinating. So if I had unlimited funds, that would be at least one of the things I would like to do.
First thing on your list.
Yeah, exactly. I think it'd also be, you know, fascinating to sort of study, you know, politicians and newsmakers and scholars themselves and sort of understand their motivations for the messages that, you know, that they, you know, promulgate to the general public. But I think that that'd be harder in the sense of, you know, there'd be a lot of resistance, I think, from all three groups, you know, to being studied. There's really no motivation for them to be on under the microscope, as it were. But I think that'd be fascinating to really sort of study the sociology of media research itself.
It sounds like you're talking about communications research as a scholarly field there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think really taking, you know, communications or social psychology and trying to understand, you know, the social processes that work among the scholars themselves. You know, to what extent are they influenced by politics? To what extent are they influenced by grant funding? Mm-hmm. You know, and our grant funding opportunities? You know, to what extent is there groupthink, you know, among these groups of individuals and such? So, I mean, I think that, you know, the confirmation, but, you know, all these things, you know, really, you know, there's this weird thing, right? In psychology, we study the general public and we sort of assume that we're sort of immune to the things that we actually, you know, observe in the general public. But it'd be fascinating to really take the social science community and put them under the microscope. And there have been actually a couple studies that have done that, but very few so far.
Let me ask a couple of questions just to close things out. First one is, have you been playing anything lately?
Yeah, I'm actually still working my way through an Xbox 360. So I'm trying. I had a backlog of games that I feel sort of obliged to, you know, to play through. And I think at this point, most of them are not very good. So
down to the dregs.
Yeah, getting down to the dregs. I'm playing a game right now called Battlefield 3. That's pretty terrible. But
yeah, I've heard of it.
I'm not wild about it, but I feel this obligation to sort of finish off these Xbox 360 games.
Well, you're like three or four behind in the Battlefield series alone.
Yeah. I get these for, like, you know, my relatives will get them for me for Christmas presents and things like that.
I heard you like violent games, Chris.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. So I'm still trying to play the original Tomb Raider. Not the original one from, like, the, you know, way back.
1998 or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the 2013 reboot. I have that on my PC actually, and I've been slowly playing.
It's really good.
We've actually used that in a couple of research studies, so I feel sort of obligated to play through the entire game. I've gotten about 2/3 of the way through.
It's funny you mention it, because I am actually currently playing Rise of the Tomb Raider, which is the sequel to that reboot.
Yeah.
And it's also really good. I like both those games a whole lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I've liked the Tomb Raider one. It's been entertaining to play. And I actually like it because it is a rare example of a shooter-oriented game that does have a very strong female protagonist in it, which is really quite nice.
Yeah, especially since the reboot. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They've desexualized her, you know, compared to the old Angelina Jolie kind of version of Lara Croft.
Yep.
And the other game I'm waiting. I've just picked up Civilization V, so I'm very excited to play that.
Man. Hope you got a few hundred spare hours.
Yeah. I tend to like those types of games. I've been really, you know, fascinated with the sort of Europa Universalis. Mm-hmm. You know, series of games as well. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're, you know, incredibly high learning curve, you know, strategy games. And there's a recent, the most recent version of them, that game has been out for probably about a year now, and I still haven't played that either. So I tend to be quite behind, you know, in terms of you know, the games that I'm playing. I just played Lego Jurassic Park with my son. So those are the types of games that we tend to play together. So that was a lot of fun to play.
Yeah.
So I'm working my way through some of the. So I play a mixture of games. I mean, you know, and I actually probably don't play as often as people might assume that I do, you know, given that I do this as a line of research. But I tend to play a lot of the strategy games. I play some of the RPGs, like the Oblivion type of games and such. And I do play some, you know, first-person shooters, but I tend to like more of the like Call of Duty type of shooters. I don't really play like the Grand Theft Auto series or things like that for the most part.
Yeah, it's kind of the curse of trying to stay current, you know, since I do a lot of writing and blogging and podcasting about this stuff. I try to at least hit the highlights every year, and I can't really dive deep into a lot of those strategy games. You know, I'll play something like, you know, it's like Civ 5, and I'll play it for a month or so, and then just feel like, I got to move on. I got to see what else is out there.
I've got to shower occasionally, yeah, right? Or eat, you know, spend time with my family or something of that sort.
Poor me, I know. Yeah, I have to play all these video games. It's a tough life I lead, but yeah, I hear what you're saying. So if people wanted to find out more about you and maybe see what you're up to and check out some of your research, where on the internet would they go?
It's pretty simple. I have a website that's basically my full name. So it's ChristopherJFerguson.com. And you can find, you know, most of my publications are there available for free, you know, essentially. I also do a little bit of fiction writing. So if people really want to read some, 50 Cent Pulp kind of fiction type stuff, then I have some short stories that are available. And I actually have a novel out if people want to, you know, help support my kids' college tuition. Then
What's the novel called?
It's Suicide Kings.
I remember that now.
It's a mystery novel.
Well, thanks so much for coming on and talking about this. I know it's a tricky topic and a contentious one, and I anticipate, you know, people sharing their thoughts, which is always great. And so thanks again very much for your time.
Not a problem. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
All right. Great.
Right. Awesome. Thanks, everybody, for reaching the end of another episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're not able to support me through the book or through Patreon, no worries, not a problem at all. But there is something you might be able to do that only takes a couple of seconds and costs nothing at all. You can go to psychologyofgames.com/podcast. And there you can find links on where to subscribe to the podcast, to give it a rating, and to follow me on social media like Twitter and Facebook. So make sure that you go check that out before the next episode comes out. Thanks, and I will see you next episode.